FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You're listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It is January 2nd, 2017. Happy New Year to one and all. And, well, everything's fine. Deutsche Bank, gotten a new lease on life. Banco Montepeschi, oldest bank in the world, gotten a new lease on life. Everything's been fixed, but do temporary fixes equal permanent solutions? That is the question. John Rubino is here to answer it. Happy New Year, John.
Hey, Kerry. Happy New Year.
All right. So here we are, 2017. Well, the stock market's closed today because today is technically the day in which we observe the new year, because when a federal holiday now falls on a weekend, I think Nixon signed this into law about 30 some odd years ago. When a federal holiday falls on a weekend, then the following Monday is the official date of observance. And that means you have off from work. But you and I, we never stop working, do we?
No, in our world, every day is a work day, Gary. Unless, like you, you want to take off a week and go to Cuba or someplace. So flexibility is nice.
That was 4 days. And hey, if you're Cuban, then every day is a holiday because they don't have anything for you to do over there because there's no free markets. And you kind of just scrounge around, try to make enough money to actually pay for the necessities of life, because $18 a month that the through the generosity of the Cuban socialist command and control economy that they've deemed adequate for your needs, you can't live on that. So you've got to find something to do. And more it's being a taxi driver or an Airbnb innkeeper or a tour guide or anything other than working for the government.
Well, it sounds like that's the trajectory, huh? They're going to be a tourist economy.
Yes.
Which means that, you know, there's a huge amount of pent-up demand for people visiting Cuba with their dollars, you know? So I think it's going to get better in a really short time for most Cubans, just because so many of you guys down in Florida and in New York, all across the East Coast, are interested in visiting, you know? It's an exotic place to us now.
I'm going to run a theme past you here. It's not so much you and me, John, our generation, but the millennials want to have a nice beach. They want to travel cheap and have cheap alcohol. Well, hey, Cuba's the place. Look,
yeah, that's pretty much me too, Kerry.
Yeah, well, you know,
I'm in that category.
I mean, you want a cheap vacation, but you do like the finer things. But millennials are willing to skimp on certain things to get other things. So the airfare, you can get there for like $150 from Florida. If you really choose, you could get there $100 round trip. All right, a beer is $1.50. Their local beer, and it's quite good, their local beer. Dining, you know, $12, $15 for a meal, and it's tasty, although the same meal you get everywhere, every place you go, it more or less looks and tastes the same, and it's good, don't get me wrong. And an Airbnb, look, mine was $100-something a night, but I could have easily picked one for $20 a night, which would have been fine. It would have been a little bit pre-revolutionary, too pre-revolutionary for my taste. But a millennial who's on a fixed budget and just wants to go party, I don't know what the drug scene is like there. That's not my thing, but I'm sure there is one. I'm sure it can be done. And I'm sure it's cheaper than here as well. So you got all these things going for it. I think it's going to take off in a big way. Higher end vacations, they're not there yet, but I think that's coming. They just opened a Starwood. The older hotels are just like need to be imploded, kind of like they should get the guys from Vegas and just go through there and just implode them and put up, you know, they got to bring gambling back if they want the boomer and the Gen X people to come. But otherwise, they're not going to do that. People will come there once, but it's not the kind of place you keep coming back to over and over again. Because frankly, I got a beach 2 miles from my house, John, that's much nicer, and I can just drive to it. I don't need to go to Cuba for it. So in any event, it will be a big hit with the millennials, though, for sure. No question about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it, you know, there's going to be a lot of money flowing into Cuba that will upgrade it over time if they decide to go that route. you know, and, yes. and I think they probably will at this point because there aren't too many alternatives anymore.
Agreed. Hey, so these banks, how did they get saved? I mean, I was telling somebody it's like Greek mythology, like the plays, the Greek tragedies, where they have the due machina, or hand of God, just reaching down because they weren't real sophisticated playwrights and they didn't know how to end them. And they basically sew a plot and then they didn't know how to end it. So they just have the hand of God reach down and save everybody. That's what's happening with our financial system here. Deutsche Bank, I mean, all of a sudden it's a sound, prudent financial institution after we've been blowing it up here for 10 years and now it's going up in value and everything's fine.
Yeah, well, you know, you described that pretty accurately there, Gary. The hand of God is now the central banks just coming down with a ton of money and fixing problems via kind of a Band-Aid. You know, we're not fixing the fundamental realities out there at all. In fact, we're making them much worse because we continue to borrow huge amounts of money. You know, the U.S. economy towards the end of 2016 and probably going forward for a few months has looked reasonably good, for instance. But a big part of that was because the U.S. government borrowed $1.3 trillion, just the federal government, in 2016, and largely in order to grease the skids for the Democrats to get reelected. And that's been filtering through the economy throughout the year. You know, it's pumped up consumer spending a little bit, and industrial production and factory output is actually up a little bit after being down for most of the last few years. But that's artificial. You know, we borrowed a ton of money. And so, of course, we're getting a little bit of growth pop from that. But now we have to pay off that debt. And since interest rates are going up, that means the cost of the debt that the government took on last year and all the debt that it took on prior to that is going to go up dramatically. You know, just a relatively small increase in U.S. Treasury bond interest rates whacked the global bond markets by over $1 trillion last year. And there's no reason to think that if we're growing, you know, if the economies of the world are actually expanding and the central banks of the world are able to normalize interest rates, that there's no reason to think that rates won't continue to go up from here. And that would just crush the bond funds that are out there and the pension funds that own tons of bonds and the governments of the world that have to refinance their debt at ever higher interest rates. You know, blow up the variable rate part of the world, which is to say most of the leveraged speculating community for sure. So this can't happen. That's where it gets really interesting because we need the global economy to grow at a reasonable, you know, historically normal rate in order for us to carry the obligations we've taken on. But if the global financial system does that, interest rates, by definition, have to go back up to normal levels. And if they do that, it blows up the world. So we're in a box that we can't get out of. Either we stay slow growing and continue to accumulate huge amounts of debt to keep that slow growth from turning into a negative growth and a depression, in which case somewhere out there, all the debt that we're taking on just blows up on us because it becomes overwhelming. Or we grow at a rate that allows the debt to GDP ratio, in other words, the amount of debt that we're taking on relative to the growth of the economy, to stop rising. And through growth, we're able to pay off a little tiny bit of our debt each year. But the cost of that will be rising interest costs on all the debt that's out there already, which will be completely unmanageable. So neither one of those scenarios works. You know, they both lead to some kind of a financial crisis, but that's really all we've got. We don't have any middle way where we grow and pay off our debts, but interest rates don't go up in response to that increasing growth. So we're stuck, and this has been the same story for the past 20 years, really, is that there's no way out of this without huge amounts of pain. And we've chosen to try to get out of this by inflating away our currencies. In other words, by borrowing huge amounts of money and creating huge amounts of new currency, and in that way, making our currencies worth less and our debt less onerous. Well, that's the classic path that has led to hyperinflations countless times in the past. And we're trying that. So that's what we've chosen. We'll see if it's possible with this much debt in the world to inflate a big chunk of it away. If we do that, we'll have a big currency crisis where nobody will want to hold our currencies, but that's what we're trying. So 2017 could very possibly be the year in which a lot of this comes to a head, because we're so deeply into a lot of these processes. Almost every major country that you look at has numbers that are completely unprecedented. You know, the amount of real debt that the US or Europe or Japan or China now carries in relation to the size of those economies has never existed before. You know, we've never carried this much debt in relation to the size of our economies. And it's not clear how much more debt we can take on without us just collapsing under the weight of it all. So it becomes more of a question of, you know, whether the crisis deriving from too much debt is coming, but when it blows up on us. And 2017 has that feel, you know, because we're at the tail end of a long, long financial asset bull market and 7-year economic recovery, which is about as long as those things usually run. So let us tip back into a completely normal and, you know, in terms of timing, to be expected recession, and then all bets are off. And that could be 2017.
Could be it, you know? I mean, it seems to have every possibility. If you remember, last year, 2016 started on a real note of pessimism. The stock market was literally getting slaughtered, and it ended on a major note of optimism. In your opinion and mine, misplaced optimism, but optimism nonetheless. Here we are, 2017, starting on this tremendous note of misplaced optimism. I think it's going to wind up the mirror image of 2016, ending on this tremendous note of pessimism, a major note.
And that's not really that unusual in presidential election years, you know, because you see the government spend lots of money to try to get its people elected. Right. And that money leads to a bit more growth than usual and a bit more optimism. So you end the year on a pretty high note in terms of headline economic report numbers. You know, unemployment looks better than it did, and factory production looks better, and et cetera, et cetera. And people start thinking things are okay. But the year after a new president is elected is usually a time when the government scales back its spending a bit to try to make up for the fact that it overspent and overborrowed the year before. And so you get the opposite effect. You know, you get a winding down of all that excess liquidity that was pumped out in the year prior. And so that leads to, you know, a commensurate amount of pessimism to offset the optimism, both of which were kind of artificial because they were just timing issues. But the difference this time around is that we can't really handle a normal amount of pessimism anymore if it's reflected in the financial markets. We cannot accept stocks going down. Really, no major country can accept a bear market in equities because we don't know what that will do to the overall financial system. So you've got central banks responding to that by buying equities out there. You know, Japan and Switzerland right now are two of the biggest equity buyers in the world. And Janet Yellen, I'm working on a magazine article about this right now, so I'm doing some background research on it. And Janet Yellen has been dropping these hints, the chairwoman of our Federal Reserve, about how it's time that she was allowed to start buying equities too. And she's approaching it from lots of different angles. You know, maybe it's time for Congress to change the law to allow us to buy assets that are more closely correlated with spending decisions from, you know, the private sector. In other words, she wants to goose the wealth effect of rising stock prices, leading people to feel richer and therefore spending more money by having the Federal Reserve intervene directly in buying equities. And, you know, this is crazy on so many different levels, but it's already being done around the world. And to the people in charge, it may not seem any crazier than buying government bonds with newly created currency, which is also a crazy thing to do, you know, but it's not as crazy as equities. Okay. So if you see these guys start buying corporate bonds, which the Europeans are doing now, or aggressively buying equities, which the Swiss and the Japanese are doing now, if we start doing that in the U.S., then you know, the distortions that we've created so far with QE and et cetera, all the experimental monetary policy of the last decade will be magnified. You know, we will have no more free markets, no pricing mechanism that allows us to efficiently allocate capital. And this this magic thing called capitalism that mobilizes millions of people pursuing their own self-interests and leads them to direct capital to uses that benefit everybody. You know, that process that has made the world vastly richer than it ever was before over the last 100 years, that ceases to work. And we'll have 9 billion people to support and no real mechanism for creating wealth needed to support them. You know, that's the longer term, really dire scenario. But it's highly unlikely that we get to that point because we've got a gigantic financial crisis coming in the short to intermediate term that will, you know, make these long-term predictions seem kind of silly because, you know, our problems are so short term, you know, and that might be 2017. It might be the year that we're heading into because we've created so many huge imbalances that are requiring ever greater amounts of fictitious fiat currency to be created and thrown at them that it's not clear we can continue too much longer.
Hey, and let me just, you made a great point about what capitalism can do, but let's be more specific what free markets are able to do. And when free markets are allowed to work their magic, there's no limit to the wealth that can be created. We've seen this over and over and over again throughout history. It's an incredible thing to see what markets can do. It's just remarkable. I mean,
it is. That's the difference between the previous 10,000 years of human history and the post-industrial revolution human history. You know, that's when we really started creating wealth. And progressing, you know, we know, obviously we know a lot more about everything now than we ever did before. And the reason for that is that we're creating the wealth that allows us to create a class of scientists who can do basic research. And, you know, so we're discovering the secrets of life and going to the stars and all that. And that's happening because of capitalism, not because of, you know, the government inventing the internet or anything like that. It's because free individuals are figuring out what's best for them and then going for it. In other words, pursuing happiness. And the marketplace creates, you know, really profound levels of democracy when people are voting with their money for the things that they want, you know, and that's the kind of thing that if the government becomes the biggest buyer of stuff and just starts buying things indiscriminately or, you know, randomly, like across the board, the S&P 500 or something like that, that changes that process from something that's efficiently allocating capital to something that's randomly allocating make-believe capital. You know, if it's just fiat currency created out of thin air, it's not even anything real. You know, it's not, it doesn't lead to a commensurate increase in societal wealth.
Exactly.
And obviously markets don't always work in every situation and they do have to be regulated because self-interest can run out of control sometimes. All of that is true. But in a clearly, cleanly regulated system in which markets are basically free within a framework of where don't dump battery acid in the river, you know, kinds of regulation, restrain the really crazy part of human nature, you get increases in wealth and you get progress. You take that away and you get the opposite. Mm-hmm. And, in this world, we are priced for perfection right now. In other words, everything has to go right for the financial markets and, you know, the labor markets and the political markets, for all of our big systems not to blow up. Mm-hmm. And yet, perfection is the least likely situation for us to find ourselves in this year, next year, and the year after. You know, we've got a lot of problems, and some of them have to come to a head soon. And then everything changes because all of a sudden these markets that are priced for never-ending low interest rates, continuous stock price increases, zero inflation, virtually no geopolitical turmoil, you know, all of those things are required for the financial markets to operate the way they are today. And we won't have any of those things pretty soon.
Well, one thing I am a little on the optimistic side about is I don't think that Trump wants to constantly provoke and engorge and intimidate Russia. You know, I don't think that's his game plan. So we'll see about the people that he's surrounded himself with. That could be another story. We've seen secretaries of state and defense openly defy presidents before on this very issue. But my feeling is Trump basically wants to defuse the situation with Russia and get on with things.
You know? Yeah, so, it does sound like that. But that's one part of a big, scary world with lots of people jockeying for power. You know, the whole South China Sea thing doesn't have an obvious fix, and the Middle East never has an obvious fix, and it's getting worse rather than better. You know, we could easily see some kind of a war between Saudi Arabia and its allies and Iran and its allies.
Yeah, sure.
At some point, which would pull the U.S. and Russia in on opposite sides. You know, the list of things that could happen, despite our best efforts, is long and growing. And a big part of the reason for that can be traced back to the same reason that our finances are such a mess. We borrowed way too much money. You know, we really don't have the ability to, for instance, in the U.S. case, finance $1 trillion a year global military empire for much longer. And if we have a financial crisis that leads us to pull back, you know, to handle our own domestic situation and leave the rest of the world to its own devices, then the rest of the world will probably spin out of control because that power vacuum will have to be filled by somebody. Yeah. On the other hand, if we dive into the world and try to affect change everywhere that change needs to be affected, we go bankrupt because we can't afford it.
That's what's been happening. Right.
Oh, sorry, Kerry. Go ahead. What? Sure. I missed that.
We've been doing that and it hasn't been working, you know, trying to change everything in the world that needs to be changed, being the world's policeman, whatever you want to call it. It ain't working.
Yeah.
We need to do something else.
Yeah. When we have a specific enemy with uniforms and coherent armies and stuff like that, like the Nazis, we're pretty good at organizing an effort to do something about them. But now the world isn't like that at all. You know, there aren't armies out there. There's nobody specific we can defeat and in that way improve the world. Yeah.
And go create ISIS.
And for the U.S., you know, our ignorance is really exposed by that, because if you look at the Middle East, for instance, we've been blundering around there for 30 or 40 years without having the slightest idea what we're doing. And most of what we do makes things worse. You know, I think the Middle East would be better off if we were just not there for the last 30 or 40 years. And, you know, it's potentially the same thing in Asia. And hopefully we can get along with Russia, but there's no guarantee, you know, going forward, because we don't seem to get what the other countries of the world want. You know, we understand kind of what we want, but we when we go in and try to impose our will on an ambiguous situation, we seem to do it really badly.
Yeah.
So and spend a huge amount of money in the meantime. You know, just the second Iraq war cost what? $2 trillion or whatever.
Ridiculous.
You know, imagine what we could have done with $2 trillion. And we're no better off there now than we were before. You know, Iraq is still in turmoil. It's not a settled Western style democracy. It's someplace that can spin out of control. Now, you know, they almost got conquered by ISIS just lately. Yeah. You know, and who knows what happens next. So that's the kind of thing that empires do when they feel like they need to do something, but they don't know what to do. They throw huge amounts of money at it and huge amounts of material and manpower, and then end up making it worse. So we're not really different from the Roman Empire, for instance, in that sense, when their borders got so far flung and there were so many barbarians out there waiting to get in, and they really didn't know what to do about it. And they ended up just messing it up and eventually dissolving. We're kind of like that in terms of geopolitics. And there's no reason to expect that our outcome, at least in a financial sense, will be any better than Rome's. You know, they had a hyperinflation where they couldn't maintain their military empire and a sound currency at the same time. So they chose the empire and debased away their currency. You know, we're trying to do basically the same thing, and we'll probably end up the same way.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, on that note, check out John's work over at dollarcollapse.com. Check out our work, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Questions, comments, feedback, criticism, just send us an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. That's kl@kerrylutz.com. John, we'll talk to you next week. Happy New Year.
Thanks, Kerry. Take care.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.